Hi, and welcome to yet another episode of the State of Retention Marketing Podcast. Today's guest with me is Rahul Raina. He's got 15 years of experience, including 12 years in product and 3 years in P&L focused roles. He's been a product guy and a business guy, and he's been leading cross-functional teams across various phases of product lifecycle and a GTV of up to $300 million. That's a lot of money. So gaming has always been a very strong area of fascination for us because it's an area which makes money, which is very intense in terms of its focus on user retention. The market has been very, very interesting in India, how the devices have penetrated and how adoption has happened. Rahul, you've had a fairly interesting journey across multiple kinds of roles, but all within the same broader organization. Yep. Would love to hear from you the key milestones from your journey, the key choices you made, and how did you land up where you did?
Thanks, Ankur. Thanks, first of all, for having us here. Yep, so it's been a long journey on mobile. That's the parent organization, which has OnMo as a product, or more than a product, it's a sub-organization within OnMobile itself. Yeah. The journey started with me trying to sell news to users on SMS. So, you know, then from news, we moved on to doing cricket alerts and sports. And
that's the VAS era where you'd pay 30 rupees a month for the subscriptions, right?
Exactly. But still make it compelling enough for the users, or tasty enough, or find the right segments, for example, or right content segments. So moved on to doing, would you believe, romance on text. So sending out romance tips for people, or dating tips, or whatever. And then also going vernacular. Vernacular, we didn't used to have the it was still in English, but we would still be giving, let's say, Haryanvi touch to for users in Haryana and so on. So that's where it started. But coming back to the gaming context there, that was when we were trying to do, or I would call it the, and I would like to believe that was the first, so to say, real money gaming initiative in the country. Mm-hmm. People used to play questions on text and voice and answer them and pay for that. And of course, the winners would be getting heavily rewarded, handsomely rewarded in that case. We have gone ahead and at that time given gratifications to the extent of, you know, giving cars, or one guy ended up winning an apartment in Mumbai. So that Mumbai apartment.
It's the same stuff, right? 56070 premium SMS for some 6 rupees, and then you apply by that and then you might win.
Yeah, that's the
time frame we're talking about.
That's the time frame, yeah. And then eventually,
massive user engagement, great monetization for the telcos as well. And I'm assuming OnMobile would also make a fair bit there.
Exactly. So we would run that as a platform for the telcos. And the period that I'm talking of had just been, as in transitioned from just text, as in, you know, we call it pull SMSs. From that, it moved to a subscription-based model. So you don't necessarily pay for every text. You pay for a subscription and you get a set of questions for that. In fact, I wonder why some of the real money gaming companies are not moving into, let's say, a tournament pack or an IPL pack. Why make users pay for $10 every day? Probably. So that was one leap that we took at that point of time. And of course, we had celebrities associated with us up to SRK itself at that point of time. So that were the early days. Post that, moved into handling music-based product, figured out the digital transformation for those products. Now that's where, again, it was the part where we felt, even to figure out the right recommendations to the users, or if you want to engage users, you know, what do you really promote to them, or what do you really recommend to them? We realized that at the very basic level, the content catalog itself didn't have many metadata fields. India music industry at that point of time. You'll be lucky if a content piece or a music piece would have the album name would be there, but you would not even have the artist name out there. That's where we started. We figured out, even if you have to do any meaningful recommendations, we first need to have a full breadth of metadata. We increased it to about 21 fields at that point of time. But then, that's what I think has benefited the entire music industry at some point of time now, with, you know, all the algorithms.
You were the ones who labeled all those music pieces with all the different metadata points.
A lot of education going in to kind of ensure that anything from mood, first to explain to, you know, content owners that why mood would make sense, you know, why to kind of classify a content in mood category would itself make sense. And that's where a lot of learnings came in, both on the you know, of course, right from how do we manage the funnel from an acquisition standpoint and how do we can continue to have users engaged. And then lastly, I've now into building a gaming platform for us. We call it Onmo. It's a cloud-based mobile gaming platform, being associated with it for about 3.5 years. It started as a stealth startup within the parent organization. I was the first member of the team. And we've gone through a series of at least a couple of pivots from a strategy standpoint when it comes to Onmo. We did, I had that aspiration at some point of time to also have a real money gaming product now in the more digital avatar of it. But again, the product strategy or synergies didn't make sense. So we had to build it. Right now we are into a subscription-based B2B2C gaming platform. Yeah.
That's always been your forte, right? The B2B2C side of distribution. You're always at the leveraging the entire ecosystem of the telcos to distribute products. So in fact, fun fact, one of my recent conversations with Biz was with Anshul, who leads growth for Airtel Digital.
Okay.
And the fact that telcos were among the very first people to think about retention as a line item, because you had to move people from prepaid 10 rupee recharge to 20. In your case, all the people who had the 30 rupee subscription for a month, that had to be carried over month on month, right? Yeah. So you would try to do a lot of very creative things with respect to data. And the fact that in that time frame, you're talking about music metadata, where all of this is still early days, right? There were not enough recommendation models. Sometimes this would probably be engaged with a consulting company to build this out for you and then put it back into the product, right? So what was that phase like? You know, this whole journey from thinking about building recommendations to actually building this metadata to actually seeing this alive and seeing it deliver some degree of incremental value. Help us understand this better, Rahul.
So one thing that's been on mobile's forte usually is that, most of the things that we've done, we've kind of built them internally over time. So we had actually ended up, first of all, when we stumbled upon this problem that we built a product, it's a music-based product. Now we want to ensure that we deliver what the consumer wants and deliver the right content to the right consumer or offer or promote the right content to the right consumer. How do we know it? And, it might sound counterintuitive. We went a heavy tech way to begin with. We use something called audio fingerprinting, because they were, let's say, external data fields available, but then they were not mapped with the binaries that or the music files that we would have, right?
Sure.
So we would figure out if there is any fingerprint matching technology that could be used to map this metadata to the content files that we have. But that we failed at that miserably. The accuracy levels were not as significant. And then it kind of embarked on us that, hey, there are simpler ways of doing it. It might be a little more tedious, a little more manual way of doing it, but it will need industry education to begin with, show them the value. And of course, we started started with offers or campaigns wherein, hey, if we would be investing into marketing of certain kind, we would only promote or only those content will feature prominently in our stores, which have the right metadata, right? So that gives incentive for the supply chain to, or the content providers is to invest into that metadata field updation. Also, I would say there were a few telcos who telcos at that time and even today, wielded more power than us in that sense. So we did get the right buy-in by a couple of telcos who again gave incentives like preferred revenue shares or preferred commercials for partners who clear out all their metadata or clean up all their fields within a specific period of time. And I think these were the incentives that really helped us sail over that problem. But then the results were phenomenal.
This is what I was going to get to, right? This is all worth it. And by how much?
I would say any channel of promotion that we would use, and that time again, let's imagine even SMSs used to be one of the heavily used channels.
Still is, surprisingly, but
I get surprised too. We've kind of reduced usage of them significantly, but I still see them being used even for digital products. I keep getting messages for wallet recharges or for that matter, fantasy game recharges on SMS.
Absolutely.
So that's interesting, but yeah. So we would see the conversions, they were so low before that, and this was a huge change. So I would say 10 times improvement in the conversions, right at the top of the funnel, basically. And then, of course, this would also help you do all the segmentations. For example, all you would need to do is start with a SMS blast of 100,000 across different regions or districts, let's say in a circle or a state at that time. And you would get responses for, let's say, a new Salman Khan movie, right? A new song that's come up. You would promote that common channel or a common access code for all the channels. And that's when you know which region resonates well with this particular content form. And that's what you then start promoting or expanding only in that particular channel, right? So within India, what we noticed is within, two consecutive districts, the stars that they would love would be completely different. Of course, Bhojpuri wasn't that prominent an industry at that point of time. But I remember in UP East itself, even for 10,000 user base or targeting base, we would have to use different artists. And let's say between Salman and Shah Rukh Khan, and that will ensure that level of micro-targeting was something that got enabled.
Curious, was there a degree of automation you were able to leverage? Because this would otherwise become operationally quite an intensive play, right?
It was, of course. So there would be, even then, back then, we would have a fairly intense BI-powered recommendation engine out there, which would also be integrated all the in the promo channels that we use.
Okay.
So all our campaign management tools, again, have been built internally for the same reason. That it's pre-integrated or designed, grounds up from an architecture standpoint, which works very well with all our internal systems from a recommendation standpoint, from a billing standpoint, and also from the tools that we use. For example, it'll be a common engine that will recommend, and now nowadays it's more, it's sometimes... Exactly. No, I would say it's more a cookie cutter solution of sorts, wherein you could be doing one push and ensuring that it goes off across different channels. But then back then, it'll be a similar or the same recommendation engine that would ensure segmentation or promotions happening on, let's say, IVRs as well as SMS or outbound dialers at that point of time. So that used to be pretty effective.
This would still be cutting edge back then. Now, of course, people have followed through and there has been more done. But back then, it seems like this was still pretty sophisticated for the times.
It was pretty sophisticated for those times, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, clearly a lot of incremental value delivered, so by all means. So, well, Rahul, tell me a bit more about Onmo. What's the story like now? What's the model? What are the products? What's the ambition?
Onmo is a gaming platform which is meant for mobile users out there. It is intended to deliver superior value or experiences than what users get to experience on any other channel out there, right?
Okay.
So what we try and do is we take really popular games on mobile, which would have generated, let's say, at least 100 million downloads wherever they've been hosted before this.
Okay.
And at a very basic level, we offer that as an, without needing any download kind of instant access to the users because it's all cloud game, right? So that's the most basic, most underlying value out there. But then we don't stop at that. And we say, you might have played this game before, but here we offer you a very differentiated experience. The content format itself is extremely different. We kind of break down the games. And that's what our USP is. We call it Moments, wherein we try and extract the most popular and exciting parts of the games and offer them as bite-sized challenges to the users to enjoy. So, even if you've played a game before, but here is the most interesting part of it that you could explore. And then that's the content part, which also weeds out all the in-app purchases, any ads that show up typically in games. So we kind of weed all of them out. And then the real value comes in, which is you could enjoy these moments along with your friends. You could either be competing with them or you could be collaborating in a co-play mode with them. So that's the real value that we deliver to the user. So you don't get to download and don't need to download any of these games. And then you get to experience a very differentiated content format in a social experience.
Fair enough. And this is where it's a subscription-based model compared to an ad-driven model, which is the norm usually in the industry. You mentioned there are no in-app purchases either. So how does that work?
Because it's all leveraged using our cloud tech, right? So of course, what happens is depending on what market we are operating in, and we simultaneously are currently, let's say Onmo itself is live in about 30 countries now. About 30 countries now. So the point there is that in certain markets, it may not necessarily be the most, our ads may not be most effective, monetization strategy based on the unit metrics involved, right? Delivering over cloud itself is a heavy infrastructure cost in that sense for every unit. So what we instead do is that we leverage our past relationships, like you said, with telcos. We use them as a channel here. And basis that, we felt And we've realized that outside India, there is a huge market for people to pay a subscription fee on a very innovative premium experience on games out there.
And this would be a part of my postpaid bill or my prepaid recharge?
It could be either.
Okay. But yeah. That's the largely the route because telcos, that's kind of where they would go, right?
Exactly. And in India, we're still looking at opportunities where it could be part of because there's no more money that users carry in their wallet. So we have opportunities where we could be bundling the product in the core offering to the users. There have been a few deals where the product has already in telco partnerships helped telcos improve their core metrics, be it both on ARPU uplift side or engagement side. Or for that matter, in some cases, telcos have used it as an acquisition strategy for announcing their 5G launch plans, right?
Wow. So, at the scale of telcos, of course, any small little delta of even a 0.01% can mean a few hundreds of crores, I would imagine, over time, right? That way, the scale to operate then becomes very massive. But Rahul, you mentioned this is a 30-country operation. So there is the inherent complexity, right? You just talked about monetization is one dimension. But besides that, also from language lens, from user journey lens, from the devices lens, it must be a fairly complicated kind of ecosystem. Now, when you look at that as a playground to work on for retention or user engagement, what does that change from your, let's say, choices on technology, choices on communication methods, choices on channels? How does it work differently across these markets?
So you're very right. You know, the challenge that we have is that every single telco that you work with, you have to kind of treat it as a different market. You have to optimize all your funnels all over again. There are, of course, some best practices that have kind of emerged over time. But yes, one needs to do that over and over again for every different telco. Now, of course, localization is the biggest draw per se, which means that whatever we offer in every country would be very localized, both from language and content preference standpoint. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to channels, I could give you a few examples. For example, here in India, OTPs is now become more. People have become more used to OTPs, right?
Sure.
But again, that doesn't necessarily transcend to digital services or when they're paying for it in other markets. For example, you'll be surprised there are markets where the channel of acquisition would make the user kind of go through a digital journey of, let's say, coming across a banner, going onto a landing page, acknowledging the service offering out there, and then eventually still needing to go over to an SMS, reply back on an SMS to say, yes, I want the service, right? Or get a SMS which has a USSD code and then you have to dial out that USSD code. So these are basically different regulatory frameworks that exist in different markets. More than the consumer needs, it is the regulatory frameworks that bring in those challenges. But the key thing is that in every country, users adopt. Adopt the framework that exists, right? So like I said, in India, people have gotten used to OTPs. This complex flow that I just explained to you, which transcends from digital to, so to say, analog in my mind, also works equally well in different markets. So for example...
What those people are used to. So.
Exactly, yeah. But it takes us some time to first kind of comprehend how these channels would work and then build the right communication around it.
Just from an organization lens, for the level of complexity you're dealing with, is this team entirely out of India? Do you have multiple locations and there are local country managers or product managers who contribute to this bit? Or how do you manage this level of nuanced handling of each geography?
Basically, there are broadly two organizations, two parts to the organization. One is the product organization, and then I would call it the business organization. So the product organization, which includes the product and the tech, this would be, for Onmo, it's kind of distributed in three broad geographies. We are headquartered here in India. The most of the product thinking happens out of India, but R&D happens out of Montreal and in Sweden. So basically there is this entire cloud element that's built out of Sweden, and then there's this entire AI visual recognition tech that happens out of Montreal. In fact, I would love to at some point explain a little more about that piece, but
we should.
But then when it comes to, in fact, we have a small dev team even in Vietnam supporting all the front end, work that happens on the product. But then when it comes to business and the marketing teams, they are fairly localized. So there would be local representatives in every region, at least, depending on big countries, there would be individuals in respective markets who understand the nuances of those respective markets. Of course, not even one price doesn't fit across all markets, right? So you will have to kind of price it very differently in the relevant markets.
Sure.
And then similarly, the teams who kind of handle the entire, the buzzword is growth lately, or it's kind of now almost gone past its prime. But the growth team, which handles all the marketing initiatives and the revenue generation initiatives, it is again centrally managed, but they have representatives in respective regions. To bring in the content expertise, the localization expertise, and so on.
But generally, from a technology lens, you said that a majority part of this is built in-house, which would mean that all of these people across these geographies would have to be trained, and the system has to be flexible enough to provide them the level of control that is needed, plus at the same time, provide you a certain degree of central control that you can exercise. So how does the balance happen between central teams versus regional teams? Who does what?
When it comes to the product building part of it, like I said, the entire ideation design thinking happens here, right? And eventually the development happens outside. Some of that has now started happening here in India. But then, of course, there are a lot of these repository-based tools where eventually everything culminates and the magic happens for it to come together. But when it comes to the marketing piece, how we structure it is that the execution of, let's say, the campaigns or initiatives, that happens locally, right? But then the insight generation piece largely is handled centrally. So there's a lot of input and strategy that happens from a central level, which is like, okay, you know what, you did this. This worked really well. Probably this should be something that we should expand on.
Do more of this, less of this kind of conversations.
So that happens majorly centrally. And then, of course, a lot of times when we have to look at, the capabilities that could be extracted from the tech tools in that sense, right? Or for that matter, even from a BI standpoint, that all happens centrally.
Got it. So in some sense, the fact that these are the major funnels to watch out for, these are the major cohorts to watch out for, I'm assuming the D1, D7 stuff exists very, very prominently in the gaming industry. So this whole analysis is being done centrally, and the insights and the actions that have been passed across to the local teams to execute from whatever language and local nuances lens.
Majorly, yes. What we also basically, the reason being that this helps us cross-pollinate best practices across, right? So for example, if we realize that there's something that's working in a particular region, as long as that's not extremely localized or there's not a, excessive nuance or local nuance attached to it, this helps us really kind of cross-pollinate, share it with others. And it also then helps us build our repository to say that and ensure that, this works in most of the markets, because like we discussed earlier, every market is a new challenge.
That's one set of nuances.
It helps us those set of preliminary activities that we know will work in most of the markets that could be just rolled out right in the beginning. And then we start optimizing over time.
Fair. So, just in terms of, you said that this is still early days in the whole journey of OnMo. Of course, with the company's history, this is just one new initiative. At the company level, you have a lot of mature practices. But as far as this whole subject of OnMo is concerned and how the business model is shaping and how retention as a line item matters in this ecosystem, because gaming is amazing with respect to its monetization. I've heard some of the best lifetime values happen in that ecosystem. So what's been your lens on prioritizing / holding out for a certain time before retention becomes an everyday conversation or every week conversation? Where does it currently fit in your scheme of things?
It's already kicked in. So I would say what we very consciously did in the beginning, and I would say probably extend over 2.5 quarters, was to focus on D0, which was, and because, in our case, the funnel works the other way around compared to any other regular D2C brand in that case, wherein we bring in the users, get their commitment. It's more like Netflix in that sense, we bring the users, get them to commit to a subscription first. Then we have to figure out how do we ensure that they continue to get charged or they continue to keep playing on the platform, right? So that's why the first thing is D0. Both in terms of charging as well as, engagement. So when I say charging, which is the user has come in, how much, what percentage of these users have been able to convert into a chargeable user or a healthy user, as we like to define it internally, within the D0 itself, right?
Wow. Is that the largest part? Sorry, please complete what you're saying.
Oh, sorry, that's cool. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, is that the largest part of the conversions? If you have, let's say, an X number of people installing the app, or this is not an app, rather, this is a web-based experience. So a cloud-based experience, rather, right? So what is the percentage of people doing it on the same day versus there's a long tail of multiple days by which they'll start to get healthy, right?
So depends on markets. I would say globally put together about 70% people, we roll out offers to say that, hey, get first few days free to experience it. Sure. And that's where the commitment is. So typically about 70% of the users fall in that kind of a funnel, wherein anywhere between 1 to 3rd day, they have to kind of, start paying for it. And that's why we kind of really, and why we use D0, or what the reason for really overemphasizing on the D0 part is that we learned it the hard way that, a post analysis sometimes doesn't necessarily help. So for example, even when you're trying to do age on service calculation or LTV calculation, you might have invested quite a bit by then, right? And what happens in the gaming / telco eco space also is that there are pockets, or there are periods that open up in which you want to capitalize on the marketing budgets out there.
Sure.
So we didn't want to fall into a trap of having spent and then realizing whether it worked or not, or the ROIs were negative and you bled for that period. So instead, we look at early indicators, right? And we map it. And then we also kind of keep validating if the indicators still hold true or not. But the idea is to look at early indicators that give us a sense that if we have made this tweak to a campaign, is it going to generate good LTV for me, right? So that's why we start looking at the D0 charging itself, or D1 charging, whichever is applicable for whatever country, which is the first time of when the user pays for it. And then that becomes the first and the immediate most feedback to either continue or sustain a certain campaign type or make tweaks to it.
Sure.
That's from the charging or the subscription standpoint, right? And the next comes in, people have committed, they've paid, but then how many of them are going on to play and experience the service, right?
Sure. Now,
the ticket sizes are not very high in this case, right? So there could be a lot of these users who kind of come in, subscribe, and then say, I'll try it later. I found it, I've subscribed for it, but I'll try it later. But that those are the users that do not necessarily generate the best retention or long-term engagement or LTVs for us. So that's why, again, the entire emphasis is to ensure that they come in and start playing and they get value for what they paid for. And that's what ensures that the users continue to, keep paying for us. I think we've been on the journey for a good 2.5 quarters. We have built a decent, engaged user base and subscriber base. And now the idea is to really focus and ensure that we retain all these users while we keep the acquisition.
Of course, adding more.
Back to your question, about 2.5 quarters in is now what we have already started. Last quarter onwards, we started building all the tools, frameworks, and then the product features that would really help. So on the retention side, what we really believe is that one is the channel and, how do you communicate? What do you communicate? But you really need to first build the right context within the product for the user to get excited about, right? If you do not have the right call to action, or if you do not have the right incentive for the user to come back, how much more segmentation you would do, it would not necessarily help. So that's the part what we've done here, which is what are those levers within the product that the players would be excited enough or triggered enough to kind of come back to? So that's been done. And now we're in the stage of kind of executing it and getting users back in.
Would this be safe to say it's a monthly renewal kind of cycle where people would get charged and they would be there for a while? And then at the end of the month, they again have a point of decision where they could choose to renew or not renew? Or are there variable time frames?
Largely monthly is the way to go. Depending on some markets, we might be.
So basically, this whole lens on games being extremely engaging on their own, but at the same time, different users will demonstrate different behaviors. And since you importantly need them to renew at the end of the month, you would want to make sure that they sort of vasulu the game during this journey, right? Yeah. Because that's the only time they'll renew. So how do you break the audience down? What kind of behaviors do you monitor? What sounds like this is definitely renewing, so I should let him be? What sounds like, oh, this guy's on the fence? And what sounds like this guy's really not going to renew? Let me do everything I can to make him to renew. How do you break this whole thing down and do something about it?
Okay, so there are various different cohorts that we look at, or more than the cohorts, there are various different behaviors that actually use a better term, behavior sure. that we look at in this mm-hmm. case. So first of all, because it's a multi-game platform, what we have really noticed is any user who moves on from playing just one game on the platform is more invested, right? So okay. what we have here is there are users who might be playing the same game over and over again versus a user who has browsed around two or three games and played them not as much as the other guy, but hey, there is medium usage on at least two or three games. Those are the users that we see staying longer on the platform. Those are the users we see getting retained or, you know, and typically we would have more than 65-70% M1 payer retention for those users.
Wow.
But then the other end of the spectrum will be users who would actually come in, play excessively, blow up all the coins that have been given to them as part of that subscription. So again, very conscious of the fact that we've paid for it, we'll make full use of it. But those are the users that I would say typically end up churning at the end of the month, right? That's a very, again, it's a very interesting trend, but, and I would say that would be around 10% of the player base, which is excessively playing, but they do not continue to play. That's like, and we typically give, in terms of duration, against a subscription, you would get anywhere between 20-25 hours of usage in a month. So imagine a user playing about 20-25 hours in a month and then not necessarily renewing. On the other
end, if you're playing too much, it's a problem.
Yeah. So on the other end of the spectrum, basically, you know, I think that's some learnings on the real money gaming side also. You do not, the best users are not the ones who keep winning a lot. The best users are the ones who are at that moderate level of winning and losing, right? And that's the kind of pattern that we see on the charging front also. Users who do not get charged enough or do not engage enough, or the users who engage excessively, both are not the best versions or the best segments out there. The ones who fall in between, both on the charging as well as the engagement side or the playing side, are the ones that we are the
so
best.
In some sense, you would for sure encourage people to play multiple games, right? So because that's like a precursor to better retention. So what would you do? Somebody who's playing a lot of game one, you'll tempt him into playing game two, and how? What would you tell them, and how would it become an incentive of some sort? Because they already paid for it. So is this the lure of the game, or what would be the excitement?
So that's when I'll go back to the context that we spoke of, we build in the product, right? Mm-hmm. So what we realized, and again, that's based on first some hypothesis that we start with, that you know, you need to have some intrinsic value for the users to begin with. If you're coming to the platform, you're playing, you need to start taking away something from it, right? That's when you feel invested into the product. And more you invest in the product, more you would kind of come back and, you know, keep engaging back with the product. So what we notice is one of the most intrinsic values that could be offered to the users is building a strong profile within the product. And that's what you then start investing.
Make him do some hard work.
Exactly. So more than the fact that, you know, if I'm just winning and losing, how do I kind of brag about it, or what do I have to show for it, right? So if I'm playing on multiple games, is that somehow brag worthy? Is there a way for me to show that that's an achievement for me, that, you know, I have conquered five different games? So that's where we bring in this entire achievement system into the platform, wherein, hey, just by playing one game, you are, let's say, a bronze level. But if you end up playing three games, you have a very nice trophy coming your way. And you could brag about it on social media. You could have your friends coming in and you could share it with them.
And that's a bigger motivation. I mean, people are playing to, in some sense, be able to brag about the shields that they've collected and the medals that they've collected.
Oh, by default, this entire thing triggered when we realized that about 20% of our users were straight away going into checking out their profile. You know, every time they log into the product, the first thing they do is checking out the profile. The next big thing is checking out their friends section.
So how am I doing compared to my friends with respect to the leaderboards on this game, is it?
One is leaderboards, but then new thing that's really emerging is streaks. You know, I've just done a best, you know, a consecutive streak of 7 wins. Has someone done better than me, right? And if it is, it's immediately for me to kind of come and beat it. That's what we use as the triggers for retention, which is the best ones that work is, hey, you know, you just dropped in your rankings on the leaderboard, come and, you know, fix it. Or you could, you know, someone just crossed your streak, why don't you come and, you know, try and reclaim your best streak out there. And eventually those nudges work beautifully, which is, oh, you know what, you're just two wins away from being called a conqueror. Why don't you kind of get through it, right? So those work most effectively in bringing users back onto the platform. Apart from, you know, let's say market-based or event-based initiatives that one would do around tournaments. But these are the ones which are most...
I mean, this human psychology, right? This whole lens on fear of missing out or the bragging rights or somewhere or the other being at the top of the tier. It just works despite all the, let's say, learnings that we might have around knowing that this is being gamed in some sense.
Yeah.
But it's gamification within gaming. So, of course, exactly. It's as real as it gets.
Exactly. In fact, we've tried in the past, you know, what other thing that really works for us at least is that any initiative that you do, you know, if you're giving that user a motivation enough not more than motivation, if you give him the sense that, you know, he has a chance, which means that whatever initiative you do, if it is as broad based as possible, it works better. So, for example, traditionally, I think a lot of gaming companies still do tournaments which are very skill based. So you come in, you get a rank you know, you might not even have to attempt again if you got a really good rank out there, correct? But then what we realized is, and then again, we're realizing there are a lot of people who used to keep coming back, but then the attempts used to be fewer because, hey, you attempt a couple of times, you realize that it's very difficult for you to get to the top of the leaderboard because just you're not matching the skill of the person at the top. So you may not attempt again. So the person who responded to your, let's say, push notifications the first time, played a couple of times, is not responding the next time, right? So what we started doing is made it a little more broad-based. You are able to top the leaderboard. The more you play, better chances you have. You don't necessarily need to be the most skilled player out there. You need to be the most committed player out there, right? So commitment in this case, or grinding in this case, becomes easier than acquiring a skill overnight, right? And that just transformed things for us. If we would initially have, you know, any such retention push, let's say if we send out, if we typically have, let's say 20% of our players responding back to it, it went up to constantly responding back to it, it went up to beyond 35-40% out.
Wow. But in some sense, this whole lens of gamification has been spoken about a lot and pretty extensively to be applicable and relevant across more places. I remember Zomato at some point started to give those titles of reviewers, which then just became a competition that I'm an ace reviewer versus I'm a, you know, food influencer of some sort. Okay. So those things around bragging rights end up being very valuable. Social currency, right, is the term that's usually utilized. And that just gets more and more people to do a behavior that is great for the brand. And while they're competing with each other, the brand is not spending money, but then they're all doing content creation for the brand.
In fact, when you specifically mention Zomato, I think they do superbly well on, you know, creating those, the FOMO effect in some sense, even... Or more than FOMO effect, make the user feel more valuable than he is, per se. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that even the year-end badges that they end up distributing to players, saying that, oh, you know what, you're the biggest foodie in the country. Oh, wow. I will be sure that. So it's just reinforcing some of those beliefs definitely helps.
Yeah, so I mean, as humans, we like to compete and we like to beat competition in whatever fashion we can. So if this becomes the place to do that, then by all means.
Even when you are competing by yourself, right? So I ordered from X restaurants or X different cuisines. I would now try and go, you know, try something else. So you're not necessarily competing with others in that case. But yeah, inherently, we are kind of tuned that way.
Chasing badges.
And probably that's why, and I think that's the biggest trigger for the gaming to be successful, even without the social aspect of it.
Well, I think given the scale at which Indian mobile penetration is now, there's so many people with so much free time available. You know, the whole bunch of security folks to the bunch of drivers who are pretty much waiting and sitting in the car, they have insane amount of time to consume content, to probably play games and to probably listen to music. And in my impression, there's a lot of appetite to pay for small tokens of time spent in entertainment in some sense. Are you able to draw some sort of a persona of your users? Who are these people? Is this a tier one, tier two guy from an economic bracket? Where does he belong? What are the major segments that are really engaged with you guys?
You know, it's very interesting that we have not yet in any sense kind of transcended into the tier. I mean, because we are, let's say, I'm just drawing a parlance in Indian context, but let's say in other markets we are big. I think we are still scratching the surface. We've not necessarily yet transitioned into the tier two segments per se, right? So the biggest segments that for us are the young professionals, which, you know, from age group standpoint, it typically lasts, you know, typically range between people between, let's say, 25 to 35 as an age group. And we've also noticed that that's where males play more. And then there is a segment beyond this, which is, let's say, 35 plus, where it's the females who play more from that segment. Now, again, whatever markets we are in, as of now, from a targeting standpoint and where we get most bang for the buck, we are still in the, so to say, their respective tier one cities or the capital cities and so on. Right? And we are still kind of generating fairly good ROIs from there. We still get decent traffic from these markets. So yes, we've not necessarily yet translated into the tier two markets in these geographies.
Matter of time and journey, I would imagine.
Yeah, of course. We'll have to, if you have to keep scaling, you have to kind of start reaching out to those segments. And also, you know, as your acquisition efforts kind of expand, your, you know, CACs from these markets would start kind of saturating. So you'll have to, of course, go there. So yeah, we are pretty cognizant of that. In Indian context, by the way, we do realize that, you know, whatever few pilots that we did in India, it's the other way around. It's very surprising that, you know, tier one city people are not necessarily the target segment. It, you rightly said, you know, it's, or not the metros, but tier one or tier two cities, is what is a very similar target segment for us or user segment for us, which is very similar to, let's say, all the people playing short format videos or watching short format videos on TikTok earlier and now browsing Instagram, yeah, right? So that used to be a very, in that limited pilot period, it used to be one of our biggest audiences or engaged user group. Sure. But then again, because it was a pilot, they were not, there wasn't much for them to pay. So, you know, once it comes to paying for it, the preference might change.
Very interesting. So, you know, so you spoke about the whole ROI lens in a very, very brief fashion. And I remember this from the conversation with Bharat, the fact that the gaming ecosystem is very savvy with respect to figuring out acquisition while being very mindful of ROAS. So they would look at not just a single cost per install, but they would look at if this guy's installed and also been activated and also been renewed. And then they'll automatically take it back to the campaign management system to optimize that. How far down the road do you go?
In fact, you know, that's one of the biggest battles per se, because, you know, what happens is from a product lens, you would, you know, of course, everyone cares for the business, but then, of course, you would really want your users to be playing more, right? And then at the top of the funnel, people who are drawing, let's say, the marketing aspect of it would typically be concerned about how much more do I draw from that funnel? How much do I monetize from them, right?
Sure.
So it's extremely imperative to really keep an eye on, you know, what's your primary metric at that point of time, but also keep an eye on how does it perform down the funnel, right? It's not going to work if you're getting in a lot of those users who are coming in, paying upfront, but not engaging, right? They're bound to churn out.
Absolutely.
So that's where in our case, while we keep an eye on those early metrics, like I spoke of the D0s of the world from the charging as well as engagement standpoint, but then we track, you know, month on month, how does the LTV turn out to be for all the acquisitions that we have done? What's the recovery period for each of those, you know, acquisition campaigns? And that's done basically at a campaign level and a channel level as well. To figure out if it continues to make sense. And then what we very interestingly devised as, so we felt that from a charging standpoint, by the way, is it's fairly easy to have those early metrics from a, you know, let's say D0 charging or D0 engagement. But what's the substitute for it when it comes to age on service, right? Which would eventually lead to LTV. So we kind of realized that, hey, you know, it's a metric that we're kind of really working on, seems to be in, you know, having a good or being fairly confident, high confidence levels when it comes to indicating the LTV values, is that we are looking at what percentage of age on service are we able to extract from the users, you know, add from a max value within a month. So let's say if you come in for the first month itself and at max, you could be here with us for 30 days, right? But then what is that we were able to get from you? So was it 20 days on an average, 25 days or 15 days on an average, right? So then you kind of compile it at a campaign level. So that's when you know that, okay, this campaign early on is giving me users who typically are going to have lesser age on service for me. And then of course we do cohorts for the successive months also. And that helps us decide that this campaign, even if the users are probably paying well, but they're not going to pay me well for a long time, right? So that's something that we need to kind of...
Which was, you know, a few notches more sophisticated than typically what we've seen in a lot of generally e-commerce companies do, which is where a lot of, you know, intrigue and respect for the gaming ecosystem, they just tend to know how to optimize the acquisition side while being very, very mindful of this retention and recovering money and making more money from that, right? Because it kind of keeps you growing, but in a very, very sustainable, responsible fashion.
Actually, yeah, I think because it stems from the fact that, you know, ours is slightly a different model, but even from an industry standpoint, it stems from the fact that unless you have engaged users out there, you do not make money in a free-to-play, let's say, which is a dominant, you know, segment out there. Similarly, every engagement pays when it comes to the real money gaming side of things also, right? And in our case, while we, I would like to believe that we have slightly more headroom compared to them because we have upfront subscriptions. And then, you know, even if you miss playing a few days, it's okay as long as you continue.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then, yeah, probably that's what is the underlying factors that makes it much more intense for the gaming companies to, you know, focus on these.
Fair. You know, one of the things I would love to pick on is this whole situation where somebody came in, burnt all their coins and now they have nothing left and they'll walk away. What do you do to prevent this from happening or to, you know, maybe we'll just, would you just give him some more coins, continue playing?
Oh, yeah. So, so we constantly kind of keep debating in our, among ourselves, which is, you know, should we, as a user, should we kind of make them feel that there's abundance of coins over here because then they start losing the value of those coins versus is it extremely tightly throttled per se, right? So what we've now kind of, like I said, we have now started looking at these segments and figuring out, you know, what could be offered to them. A campaign that we did last month worked well, at least early indicators were decent, which is, you know, the moment any a user is reaching to, let's say 90% of his exhaustion, you offer him a top-up pack and say, you know, the first top-up is on us. And the top-up usually is fairly dynamic, which means that there's no specific, you know,
the variable
value or standard value. It's a value that we estimate is sufficient enough to allow them to sail through the month, basically. You know, so they see the value, actually not just a month plus few days so that they continue to, you know, cross that threshold of the next renewal, basically.
Time to renew.
Exactly.
So, you know, I remember folks like Candy Crush and all used to make people send requests to their friends to borrow coins from them.
Yeah.
Have you tried any of those things yet?
No referrals and, you know, they also had something called bank wherein, again, the more friends you have, there will be money added out there. We definitely extremely strong tools. I do not necessarily have our executed it yet, but extremely strong tools out there. In fact, if I go beyond gaming in our earlier you know, products that we've handled or we still do, let's say in music, you know, sharing playlists, for example, or sharing a common subscription wherein, hey, three people share a subscription.
Right.
It's a common subscription and you keep adding songs. It's a shuffle that you keep adding.
Sure.
That used to be at least 3x more ARPU than, you know, a regular one-time user.
So you actually like people who share subscriptions? I mean,
oh, exactly.
Unlike Netflix, of course.
Netflix also kind of, I think, you know, they maximize the benefits that they could by allowing people to share. It's not without that they've reached about 6 million households here. I don't know whether it's households or users, frankly. But yeah, I think it works. It works very well for people to have those combined subscriptions or ability to kind of share stuff for a common progression out there on the platform. It really works.
Very interesting. So, well, gaming industry is notorious for driving addiction, but is there a lens on, you know, where do you draw a line on how much should a user play and where should you kind of stop him? Early for you, I would imagine.
Not at this point, Ankur. I would love for them to play as restrictively as possible.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot more addictive stuff that's happening outside of your ecosystem for them to be worried about, I'm sure. But awesome, Rahul, I would have loved to dig a lot more deep, but today this is the time that we'd allocated for this. Thank you so much for joining us. Extremely insightful for me. I'm pretty sure I'm going to remember some of the examples you've given me and they'll get quoted across more conversations. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ankur. Bye-bye.